This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Opposition to trade was a rallying cry in the presidential election for supporters of both Republican Donald Trump and Democrat Bernie Sanders. Now President-elect Trump has promised that on his first day in office, he'll begin to renegotiate the North American Free Trade Agreement and ditch President Obama's proposed Trans-Pacific Partnership. It's all part of Trump's key campaign promise to bring jobs back to this country. And indeed, this week, the president-elect said he'd brokered a deal to prevent nearly 1,000 jobs at an Indianapolis manufacturing plant from moving to Mexico. But Trump's desire to pull back from international commerce has many economists, businesses, and U.S. trading partners concerned. And today in The Exchange, we look at shifting trade winds for global trade. Let's hear from you. Your questions, comments, concerns are welcome. 1-800-892-6477. Give us a call, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. We have two guests for the hour. Arnie Alpert is with me in studio. He's New Hampshire co-director of the American Friends Service Committee. He's looked a lot at trade over the years, including NAFTA. Arnie, nice to see you. Welcome back.
Great to be back.
Also with us from Hanover, Matt Slaughter, Dean of Dartmouth College's Tuck School of Business, and again, a longtime observer of international trade. And Matt, great to have you too. Thank you for your time. Matt Slaughter, are you with us? Can you hear me?
I can.
There you are. Thank you so much, Matt, for being with us. We appreciate it. And I want to turn to you first, Matt, as someone who has long looked at these deals, both as a professor, but also as someone active in politics in D.C., at the White House, on Capitol Hill. What do you make of the sentiment that we saw this time around? Pretty strong anti-trade sentiment during this election.
Great big question. That sentiment is very real. It has been building for a generation at this point, and it needs to be addressed. I think one data point that is very striking to put all this into context is you line up all the households in America and look at the median household, the kind of right in the middle in terms of their total income that they earn. Last year, the total median income of that household was $56,516. And what's striking is that's about 2.5% less than it was in the late 1990s. And so that I think, is a real summary of the real issue that America faces, which is the benefits of trade and globalization more broadly, which are very real and very large historically and have the chance to be that way in the future, and some of the gains of technological change and all these other dynamic forces, they're not directly benefiting as many workers and companies as communities as we might like. And there's a lot of families legitimately wondering about where they're economically, where the future is going to be, and that needs to be addressed.
Arnie, what do you think?
No, I think Matt's right. I mean, I think that we're dealing with a couple, not really, I'd even say a couple generations of wage stagnation, while most of the growth that is happening, particularly since the last big crash, has gone to the ultra-rich. Laura, I was at Thanksgiving dinner with my cousins, and my cousin Gary, he's just turned 60. He's been working in sales for a high-end audio company, and he's just lost his job because the jobs that this company has are shifting to the Philippines. Now, again, we think about manufacturing jobs as being what everybody's been talking about, like Carrier in Indiana, but this is not even they probably haven't been manufacturing in the United States for decades, if they ever did. But Gary, who's in sales, is going to be out of work at age 60. And he could qualify for trade adjustment assistance. But what's a 60-year-old, what's he going to get retrained to do, spend a year or two getting retrained for a new career?
I mean, that's rough. Who's going to hire a 60-year-old?
Yeah. In fact, his younger sister was thrown out of work in a company that made desktop publishing software. She got thrown out of work about a decade ago when those jobs moved to India, has not found her way back into the workforce. So again, these are real things affecting real people, real families across the United States. Trade policy is part of it. The issue of the global economy, the ability of employers to pick and choose all over the world for where they're going to hire people or outsource their work to, is creating insecurity.
Well, it was interesting, too, this time around, not just this, you know, groundswell of anti-trade sentiment, but that it was so strong on both sides. Let's hear a little bit, guys, from Bernie Sanders. This is Senator Sanders appearing on the show The View 4 or 5 days after the election. Again, showing you the bipartisan opposition to trade.
Trump has a fair point, something I've been saying for a long time. Workers all over this country are seeing their jobs going to China and Mexico. Their wages have gone down significantly. Let's create a trade policy that gets corporate America to start investing in this country.
So, again, the fact that he says, you know, jobs being lost to other countries, and Matt Slaughter, Arnie mentioned two relatives who've lost jobs to other countries. But let's hit on that point a little bit more, Matt. How fair is it to say that the jobs that Trump, Sanders, and others mention have truly been lost to other countries? And how many have been lost to other forces instead? You know, automation, consumers moving on. For example, we don't have a lot of travel agents these days. That used to be a reasonable business. So I just wonder how fair it is, Matt, to blame trade for those job losses.
Yeah, if we blame trade entirely, that's not fair at all. So, again, a little more data can help. Around the time that household income peaked in the United States in the late 90s that I mentioned a moment ago, we had about 17 million manufacturing jobs in the United States. Today, we have about a little over 12 million manufacturing jobs. So we lost, in some sense, about 5 million jobs in manufacturing during that time period. And there's a lot of academic and policy research that's been done. And the consistent finding is that the majority of those jobs lost disappeared because of technological change, not because of trade. So some studies estimate that maybe upwards of a quarter of those jobs were lost to trade, and in particular to rising imports from China after they joined into the World Trade Organization. So that's not to belittle those 1.25 million trade lost jobs. But when we talk about bringing those jobs back, that is challenging to think about how that's going to happen, because a number of those jobs have been automated away around the world in turn. Even in China today, the number of total manufacturing jobs is falling, not rising. Some of those jobs have been lost again to other countries like India and Indonesia. It's simplistic to think it's all trade and that there's some sort of magic wand that can be waved by any president, be it a Republican or a Democrat, that's magically going to bring back millions of jobs to the United States. That's simply not the case.
Well, Secretary of State John Kerry spoke about this a week or two ago. Here's what he said, and I want to ask you, Arnie Alpert, what you think. Kerry said, "I just saw earlier today a statistic that 85% of job loss in the U.S. is due to technology, not trade," Kerry said. "So we're running around hearing people battle a dragon called trade when, in fact, it's not the fundamental problem. It's the structure that we have underneath the trade that doesn't provide the social safety net." Instead, Kerry went on to say we should be encouraging education, job training, higher wages, addressing the real factors behind income inequality instead of blaming trade. I wonder what you think, Matt. Arnie.
Great. I want to think two things. One is I was yesterday looking at some New Hampshire statistics on this, sort of similar to what Matt was just mentioning. From 2002 to 2013, the manufacturing sector here in New Hampshire, the output went up by about 15% during that period of time, and the number of manufacturing jobs in New Hampshire went down by about 25% of that time.
So is that due to efficiency, productivity,
yeah, automation,
technology?
I mean, all these other things. So it's not necessarily that we are losing manufacturing as a sector or that manufacturing is becoming less important in the U.S. economy so much as it's being done more with machines. Robots are replacing people, you could say, for things like that.
So don't blame trade, blame
automation? So I would say that that's part of it. But the other thing that I want to make sure that we're talking about is that we need to make a distinction here in our conversation between trade, the sales of goods or services across borders, and trade policy and trade agreements like
yes.
the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the World Trade Organization, NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, the rest. Anyway, because when we get into the weeds of those trade, so-called free trade agreements, what we find is that these agreements are massive documents creating rules covering broad swaths of the economy, talking about intellectual property, talking about government procurement, talking about domestic regulation, talking about investment in ways that are creating great benefits for the global corporations and investors to the disadvantage of workers, not just in the United States, but all over the world.
Well, that's an important point, Arnie. I'm glad you brought that up. Matt, I wonder, is the opposition to trade about, as Arnie says, you know, us selling goods to France or Canada or whoever? Or is it about these ginormous agreements and nobody really knows what's in there, but it looks fishy?
So I think there is a concern a lot of people voice about the complexity of these trade agreements, distinct from trade per se. When you look at public opinion evidence, it's still the case today, even given the ambivalence that roiled through our elections, that a majority of Americans acknowledge the benefits of being connected to the global economy. And this is a really important point I'll come back to, because that reflects the fact that all the research shows, which is companies that are connected to the global economy through trade, through investment, through employing high-skilled immigrants, for example, they tend to be much better performing companies, and that means in no small part that they pay higher wages. So I will respectfully disagree a little bit with Arnie on this. Yes, these agreements are complex. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, for example, took several years to negotiate, but that's precisely because it aspired to bring large parts of the U.S. economy into a system of rules and regulations that would have generated a large number of benefits for American companies and their workers alike. So we mentioned intellectual property. One of the real strengths of America is our innovativeness, the creativity of coming up with new technologies. Think of how many global American companies are at the forefront of information technology, for example. The ability to protect those investments made by American workers here around the world would really benefit companies and workers here in America. So, yes, these agreements are complex. Yes, I think some more transparency about the process would help gain political support for these agreements. But if we walk away from the TPP, all of the studies show we will be walking away from greater exports, greater output for America, and higher average wages because of that agreement.
Well, and I don't think it's an if at this point, Matt, right? I mean, everything I've read says TPP is gone.
I think that's right. Donald Trump has said a number of things, but it appears that after inauguration up on Capitol Hill, he'll stroll down Pennsylvania Avenue to the White House, and one of the first things he will do is officially notify the other countries that the United States is withdrawing from the TPP efforts to translate the agreement into law.
Well, let's hear what
happens. We'll see.
Let's hear what President-elect Trump said about his plans for the first day in office. And you're right, Matt. A lot of it was about trade. Let's hear.
On trade, I am going to issue our notification of intent to withdraw from the Trans-Pacific Partnership, a potential disaster for our country. Instead, we will negotiate fair bilateral trade deals that bring jobs and industry back onto American shores.
Again, that's Donald Trump talking about his plans for his first day in office. And what do you think, Arnie Alpert, the bilateral trade deals? You know, he seems to be saying those are more fair than these big giant ones that seems suspicious.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, again, we can talk. Yes, he can pull us out of the TPP. And in fact, it looks like he can even pull us out of NAFTA, something that we've been in for 20 years now. Whether he can negotiate bilateral agreements and whether those are going to bring back jobs, you know, good jobs to the United States, that's speculation that it's pretty hard to figure out right now.
Would those be, quote unquote, better, Arnie, bilateral agreements?
Not necessarily.
No?
No. I mean, again, I think Matt and I agree that a lot of this is about what are the rules of the global economy that are being written into this. This is not just about trade per se. I mean, I'm thinking back to the formation of the World Trade Organization in 1994, the first executive director, whatever he was called, general secretary, a guy named Renato Ruggiero, was famously quoted saying, "We are writing the constitution of a single global economy." Right? What a statement. All right, so you've got all these intersecting agreements. You've got the WTO, you've got NAFTA, you've got TPP, you've got probably hundreds of bilateral investment treaties, all with like slightly different sets of rules for how the economy is going to go. And then you have these global corporations which are operating within this mesh. Even just right here in New Hampshire, think about it. Our largest manufacturing companies are companies like BAE, which is based in Britain, and Freudenberg, which is German, and Sig Sauer, which is German, and which sells hundreds of millions of dollars of firearms to Mexico. Right. That's so when we talk about jobs, we might be talking about selling of guns across borders. I mean, we're talking about our two biggest banks in the state being foreign owned. We're talking about Hannaford Supermarket being part of a Dutch company. So this is all here.
Is that necessarily bad, though? I mean,
no, I'm just saying,
Ford has plants in Germany.
It's not bad. But part of the question, Laura, is what happens when you get disputes about, again, government regulations, environmental rules, some types of restrictions, rezoning? Does a global corporation get to then get its home government to file a claim through the dispute resolution mechanism of any one of these dozens of agreements, or even be able to go into a direct investor state dispute resolution process, in effect filing a suit against the government because they believe that some policy is unfair and is contrary to the terms of one of these agreements, which were negotiated in secret and have these disputes resolved through a private tribunal rather than going into an open court. These are the
an
types
American
of details.
Court or a New Hampshire court.
Or a German court. I mean, just not, you know, if the dispute resolution process is more like commercial arbitration between two private companies instead of the way we expect, you know, a dispute, say, between the how do we interpret a difference between a state law and a federal law, and we work that out in court. What you know? Where is the precedent? Where is the power here? Who really has the authority in this case? This is a different set of rules, and this is part of what makes people rightly suspicious about the global trading system.
Yeah, if you could address that too, Matt, that one of the big issues with these agreements like NAFTA is the concern about jobs, and we've talked about how much you can really blame trade agreements for the loss of jobs. But what about the point that Arnie makes that, you know, some of these agreements and organizations like the WTO make it harder for us as Americans, as Granite Staters, to impose the types of things we would like to see? Water quality, for example. I mean, if a foreign company, you know, damages local water quality, how much control do we have as Americans to say, hey, you can't do that?
So Arnie's exactly right when he articulates the complexity of what it means for companies and their workers to be connected to the global economy today. I think a lot of people have in their mind this still this metaphor from the past, which is trade is about border taxes and you've got ships and cargo on ships. That still happens. It's vital with containerized shipping and all that happens on our oceans every day. But the complexity that he talked about, again, we talked about intellectual property. He mentioned rightly government procurement, investment rules, environmental standards, labor rights. The complexity of how these companies operate, and yes, some of the strongest employers in New Hampshire today are affiliates of foreign multinationals. I'll come back to that in a moment. The reality is you need a system of rules, and it's difficult to negotiate. It takes time. It's a lot of countries involved, which is why the TPP took several years to negotiate. And I'll come back to one example, which is unfortunate when we walk away from the TPP. One of the biggest challenges that our workers in America face and our companies is when we're competing in foreign markets against state-owned or state-affiliated enterprises. Countries like China, for example, huge swatches of their economy are run by companies that are owned by the government entirely or partly or received state-subsidized loans and all these kind of shadowy activities. The TPP had a whole set of rules to restrict and make much more transparent where governments are trying to tip the scales in global commerce. So Arnie's exactly right that it's complex. The reality is I don't see a better alternative to having these sorts of meticulous agreements through forms like the World Trade Organization. And again, I'll come back to why all this matters is we really care about good jobs at good wages in America. We live in an economy that is so dynamic that every month in the United States in recent years, about 5 million jobs are destroyed every single month in terms of worker-company matches. Now, fortunately, in recent months, slightly more than that are created. So the net job creation that we tend to hear about and the press tends to focus on once a month, it masks a tremendous amount of dynamism and churning that's happening across in New Hampshire and across all our states every hour that America's open for business. It's over 30,000 jobs destroyed every hour. So the fundamental challenge we need is we need a much stronger, broader, better-funded social safety net as part of these broader agreements for how we connect to the world, I think.
And that was the point Secretary of State Kerry was making. Coming up, we'll turn to your questions and comments, thoughts about why trade was such a huge issue in this past election and how our current approach might change. Stay with us. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the new outlook for trade, given that anti-trade sentiment was a big part of the election this year. Give us a call, the Exchange number 1-800-892-6477. What do you make of this opposition to trade that was a big feeling on both sides during the past election? And do you think this anti-trade feeling will help or hurt our economy? Again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. Send email to exchange at nhpr.org. nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Arnie Alpert's here, New Hampshire co-director of the American Friends Service Committee, along with Matt Slaughter, dean of Dartmouth College's Tuck School of Business. And we were talking, guys, about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which everybody says is probably not going to happen now, given the makeup of Congress and given Donald Trump's strong opposition to this. Arnie, to you, The Atlantic magazine wrote a piece in defense of this much maligned trade deal, saying it would have increased regulations on foreign labor, meaning the other countries involved in this, Vietnam and other countries, and that would have increased the cost of labor in those countries, making U.S. workers more competitive. So The Atlantic, anyway, is saying, hey, this was a good deal for Americans.
Yeah, I'd say on the labor stuff, one of the things that's been clear going all the way back to NAFTA, and you might even remember in NAFTA, Clinton was forced to negotiate a so-called labor side agreement to try to say Mexico needs to raise its labor standards. We are, again, we as workers are competing in a global labor market right now, and what we need to do is figure out some way in which the interests of workers in all countries can be protected so that instead of having a race to the bottom, we are having something that the economists would call upward harmonization, but upward harmonization of labor standards and how to figure out how to work that into these agreements. For example, can we say that if a country does not actually protect the rights of workers to organize unions and bargain collectively, that they should maybe not even be allowed to be part of one of these agreements, and that if places, for example, have a right to work for less policies at the state
what or
federal
level.
Some people
call right to work,
yeah,
yeah, which
maybe,
New Hampshire is
right,
considering.
Right, right. So if you've got limits on collective bargaining, then your workers are not getting treated fairly in the local or in the global economy, and maybe you shouldn't be allowed in to some of these trade systems.
So do you think that The Atlantic has a point that the TPP would have actually helped American workers?
I think that you still would have had American workers, in effect, directly competing with workers in countries like Malaysia and Vietnam, where the rights of workers are clearly not, and still Mexico, for example, where, again, it's very difficult to organize. And the TPP might have added a little bit of pressure. But again, the record from the agreement with Colombia, the agreements with Mexico, the agreements with Central America and Guatemala, we're not seeing those other countries stepping up their labor regulations in ways that the interests of workers are actually protected.
So those promises have been made before, and you're saying skeptical that it would have happened.
I'm extremely skeptical.
This time. What do you think, Matt?
I think the tragic irony, to the extent that we care, and I think we all should deeply, about the economic prospects of the poor around the world is the less we allow them to connect to the global economy, the harder we make it for those workers and their families in the countries to climb out of poverty. The empirical evidence is very clear that when workers in emerging markets are allowed to connect to the global economy through trade and investment, their incomes rise much more quickly, and a whole host of other personal and social benefits arise from that. China is a prominent example. Now, again, the political challenge is China engaging in the global economy has accentuated pressures on a lot of American workers and communities. That's very real. But if we're focusing on those emerging markets, I just worry that consigning the TPP to the past is letting the perfect be the enemy of the good.
President Obama, despite how he campaigned in 2008, ended up being a big supporter of trade and, as we've been saying, promoted this Trans-Pacific Partnership. Let's hear the president remarking on how trade was, I don't know, could we say it was dealt a body blow in this election? Here he is just about a week ago talking about trade and what happened.
I firmly believe that the best hope for human progress remains open markets combined with democracy and human rights. But I have argued that the current path of globalization demands a course correction. In the years and decades ahead, our countries have to make sure that the benefits of an integrated global economy are more broadly shared by more people and that the negative impacts are squarely addressed.
So a course correction, Arnie Alpert, to use the president's words. What do you think that would look like?
I know. I just remember I had a couple of conversations with Senator Obama about trade policy back when he was running for president for the first time. So we don't necessarily need to go there. But I think clearly a course correction is in order. And one of the ways that we could get there is change the way we actually approach the negotiation of our trade agreements. I mean, and one of the problems right now within our own U.S. system is that our trade negotiators look almost entirely for advice to representatives of the global corporations. So they're not interested in the perspectives of people who are looking to the protect the environment or a consumer interest
or labor
interest.
So those folks aren't at the table.
They're mostly not at the table. Once in a while, there's a few tokens that are allowed in, but there's a system of trade advisory committees which are organized by industry that are through the Commerce Department, and it's like aerospace equipment, automotive equipment and capital goods, chemicals, pharmaceuticals, health science, products and services, distribution services, energy and energy services. And if you look at who are the members of those, it's all representatives of corporations.
So who else should be
there? I was looking at the one on intellectual property yesterday, and it's like it's Disney is there, but there's nobody who represents the interest of people who actually need to use medicine, who's where the cost of pharmaceuticals is affected by intellectual property.
So who should be at the table?
Well, I would say that you need to have representatives of workers. You need to have representatives of consumers. You need to have representatives of state and local governments whose own authority to regulate our state and local economy is being impinged on by the details of these global trade agreements.
A bunch of emails have come in, gentlemen, and I want to share them with you and also encourage you to send an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Facebook or Twitter is NHPR Exchange. And you can give us a call to 1-800-892-6477. Here's one that just came in from Pat. I want to hear from both of you. Pat says, to what extent do your guests feel that the demands of U.S. unions have been responsible for companies moving abroad? Have union wages and benefits become excessively expensive, thereby necessitating companies looking for cheaper labor? I want to hear from both of you. But Matt, you first. Go ahead.
It's a great question from Pat. I think there's we can find all kinds of examples of labor unions in terms of how they try to engage with their employers. There's a number of terrific, innovative, forward-looking unions that partner with companies and try to find ways to create good jobs and maintain jobs by being flexible and recognizing the environment that they're in. I think the broader issue that Pat's question touches upon, though, is important to understand. The dynamism of the global economy and the economic incentives are present regardless of how many workers in the United States we have unionized or not, not to denigrate unions in any way. But I think one fact to help frame this, think about India. We talk about China a lot, and India is this emerging market as well that within about 10 to 15 years will become the largest country on the planet in terms of population. Per capita income in India last year was about $1,900 per person. So that means just the economic incentive of it's a large market, it's a potentially growing market, and what that means for what kind of jobs are located in the United States, it's going to be the case for the many moons ahead that the kinds of jobs we want to try to create in America, they need to be high productivity, creative jobs. Those are the kinds of jobs that can sustain good wages in America. And again, the reality that's very clear in the data is globally connected companies through trade and investment tend to pay much higher wages than do companies in the rest of the economy.
What about the role of unions, Arnie? What do you think about Pat's email? And since we're talking about manufacturing, that is a sector that tends to be more unionized.
Sure, let's look to some other countries too. Let's look to Germany, which has a much more highly unionized part of their labor force, including in manufacturing. And they do quite well with exports and with their manufacturing sector. So I don't think that it's unions or unionization itself that is causing this problem. I think it has to do actually with the fact that there's too much power in the hands of the corporations and the investor class, the so-called 1%. They have too much power over the economy. They benefit more by this flexibility that they have that workers do not have right now. Workers are disadvantaged in the global economy at the present time, whether they're unionized or not.
Let's take another call. This is Jonathan in Concord. And Jonathan, go ahead. You're in the exchange. Welcome.
Thank you, Laura, and good morning, guests. Yeah, I just want to express the point how a large portion of Americans, including myself, really believe that we're essentially living in an oligarchy. It's a government for the rich, by the rich. And when this trade agreement, the TPP, was being developed over years, as your guests had expressed, with basically zero transparency, it was very hard for people like me to have trust that it's going to be something that is looking out for our interests, the middle class, the working class. I think if we are really serious about open and free global trade, the process needs the appearance of a trade agreement that isn't going to help us. It's just going to help the rich. I think a large part of why it's failed.
Well, Jonathan, thank you for the point. And, you know, Matt, Arnie talked about this a minute ago, looking at who's sitting at the table, so to speak, in these agreements. It doesn't look like your average Jane or Joe. What do you think?
I will say that the negotiations for the TPP and President Obama's main trade negotiator, Mike Froman, and his team at the U.S. Trade Representative Office, they were the most transparent and open trade negotiators, I think, of any agreement the United States has had. I totally understand and share the sentiment of Jonathan and wanting to have a sense that our elected officials, whether it's our congressional representatives, whoever's in the White House, in some sense is working for us Americans. The reality, and this has been true for generations, is the nature of our representative democracy is you have to have individuals that are empowered to negotiate on behalf of the United States overall with other countries. A fundamental thing to keep in mind about these trade negotiations is they're treaties with other countries. So just like a military treaty, when we send the Secretary of State abroad, she or he negotiating on behalf of the United States, the same dynamic has to hold when we are trying to set the rules of the economic road with other countries. So then there's always got to be this delicate balance about how much individuals or members of Congress are informed about the status of those negotiations. And always we should be erring, I think, on the side of more information, more transparency. But at some point, if you disempower the president from negotiating these treaties, we will have no treaties.
Jonathan, thanks for the call. You can join us, too, at 1-800-892-6477. Facebook or Twitter, you can contact us at NHPR Exchange. You can send us an email, too, exchange@nhpr.org. And Arnie, go ahead, jump in
just
there.
Just one quick thing. I mean, even at the World Trade Organization, when they are negotiating changes in their rules, the drafts are made public in bracketed versions so you can see which are the things that the different parties have agreed to and where they have disagreed, and it's possible for the public to understand more about what is going on, what they call the state of play, where something like the TPP was taking place in secret and even members of Congress were largely barred from being able to figure out what was going on, or they could go into a secure room at the Capitol where they weren't allowed to take notes or bring in any trade lawyers with them and stuff. And again, these are documents that are thousands of pages long.
So we need
a system that is much more transparent than what we've got right now.
So that's a real disagreement between you and Matt, Arnie. Matt just said this was one of the most transparent.
Well, it may have been, but that's a low bar. And I would say the WTO process has been more transparent, and Matt may agree with that.
Go ahead, Matt, and then I've got some emails I want to share with both of you.
No, look, the Jonathan's sentiment and Arnie, his data, I share the desire for more openness and transparency is great, and yet it's not unrelated to the fact that the WTO has had no new trade treaties of any material impact almost since its founding. It was created in 1995 as a successor to what used to be called the GATT, the General Agreements on Tariffs and Trade. And I think most commentators would say they had one very substantial trade agreement early on, which was a free trade agreement in the information technology industry. But they've struggled with what has been called the Doha Development Round since its inception, at this point almost 15 years ago. So the reality is there just needs to be a balance. Transparency and openness is a wonderful virtue that I share, but it's got to be balanced with the ability of negotiations to happen through elected representatives.
A couple emails I want to share with you guys. Here's a note actually from Lorna, a caller who couldn't stay on the air. She sells to high-tech companies. She thinks her job will be gone within 5 years due to the Internet. She thinks the Internet will drive sales overseas. Arnie, you mentioned earlier a relative who was in sales and had lost his job to trade. Maybe you can't blame trade. Maybe you can blame the Internet, people shopping online.
No, it's all, you know, I would even say, Matt, you got to watch out for the college professors, you know, who might be competing with online delivery of educational services in the next couple of years. So, or radio, Laura. I mean, this show could be originated out of Bangalore. So,
but that's not really trade. It's
online.
Well,
that's again,
I mean,
but the rules that govern how this happens are being made through these so-called trade negotiations. That's what part of the problem is. Again, the rules of the global economy are being set through what is called trade. And it involves way more than that.
But it's a lot more than just, you know, I sell you some oranges and you sell me some
bananas.
Again,
as Matt said, it's not just about freighters crossing crossing the ocean seas anymore.
You know, Matt, what do you think about Lorna's point that, you know, so much business is done online that that's where the jobs are going?
It's a really important point because it just speaks to what Arnie just nicely articulated. The complexity between technological change and global connectivity is so interesting and pervasive. It speaks to when we think about policies, we should be a little careful when we want to give voice to saying this particular company or these jobs are being affected by one force rather than this other force. I think the reality is so many companies and their workers are dealing with a whole set of deeply interconnected forces of global connectivity, technology innovation, capital investment. That's part of the inherent dynamism in the global economy in which we live. And Arnie is right. Boy, for us in higher education, if we just want to keep doing what we did in the past, technology may end up being quite disruptive. But I know I speak for a lot of my colleagues at the Tuck School and at Dartmouth. We're very excited about the prospects that technology presents to allow us to teach differently, to access more students in more creative ways. And that's an example, though, of the what sometimes gets called the creative destruction that technology and trade create. And as part of that, I come back to a theme that I think we've been talking about here, which is so important. We need to have some way to have what I wrote a piece about 10 years ago called a New Deal for Globalization. We need to have some way that more individuals directly benefit from all these dynamic economic forces and have a hope that their children in particular will as well.
Well, like we heard in that cut from President Obama expressing the same support for trade, Matt, but also the recognition that the benefits could be extended to a wider number of people. Here's an email from Nancy in Durham. I'm going to throw this to you, Arnie, because it concerns another issue that you care about. Nancy says, what does research show about the role of global trade in maintaining peace? Nancy says, intuition would suggest that countries who have economic relationships are less likely to go to war. But does research support this supposition? Nancy, it's a great point, one I hadn't thought of. Thank you.
No, I think it's a reasonable point. I mean, I think you can go back to the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade that Matt referred to earlier that was part of the resolution of the Second World War, created basically at a meeting up at Bretton Woods in New Hampshire. So we've got a little geographic connection to that. I think that that's fair. And I think that, again, so let's look at TPP. Laura, one of the objectives of the Obama administration in TPP was to create an economic bloc that isolated out China and centered on the power of the United States. Now, what that was doing was exacerbating tensions with China at the same time Obama was doing this military pivot toward Asia, raising the level of global tension, harming the prospects for peace, when if we had been doing a better job of how do we work with China, we might have been in a better position.
So to
and
Nancy's
we might be in a
point,
better position now.
In, to Nancy's point, sometimes yes, sometimes no.
I don't disagree with Nancy.
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll talk more in just a moment and take a lot more of your emails at exchange@nhpr.org or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, how and why opposition to trade agreements was such a huge issue in this past election and how our current approach might change. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. What do you make of the anti-trade sentiment from candidates from both parties this time around in the election? And do you think overall pulling back from some of these global trade agreements will help or hurt our economy? Again, 1-800-892-6477 is the number. Email exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Arnie Alpert, New Hampshire co-director of the American Friends Service Committee, and Matt Slaughter, dean of Dartmouth College's Tuck School of Business. And Matt, to you, just before the break, we were talking about a really interesting email from Nancy in Durham who said, intuition suggests that countries who have economic relationships are less likely to go to war. So does global trade help improve prospects for global peace? Arnie talked about that, but I'd like to hear from you too, Matt.
Yeah, it's a great question. There was this old saw, I don't know who it's attributed to, but that two countries that each have a McDonald's restaurant never went to war with each other. And over much of the 20th century, that was true. I believe it's no longer true, unfortunately. But it speaks to the sentiment that Nancy voices, and a lot of academic research shows that different ways when countries are connected economically, there's a bundle of relationships that get built at the personal level and at the policy level that does tend to support
less belligerence between those countries. And I think one of the things to stress is the flow of people in this. We've talked a lot about trade, but one of the really important dimensions of globalization that has mattered so much in the United States in recent years with our elections, with the Britain's Brexit vote, is the flow of people. And it's definitely the case that when you have more people crossing borders, especially in educational context, that builds personal and professional ties that tend to foster peace in addition to prosperity.
Here's an email that came in from Steve, who says, Mr. Trump kept using Apple as an example of jobs lost to China. He says what needs to be understood is that the assembly of iPhones is mind-numbingly boring and requires excellent manual dexterity. It isn't just the hourly wage advantage of doing this work in the Far East. It is next to impossible, Steve says, to find workers in the U.S. to do this. He says, I speak from experience, was responsible for semiconductor assembly in Manila for a major company back in the 80s. Wow, Steve, good to hear from you, given that experience. And Matt, I'll turn to you first on that.
Steve's point is really important. It speaks to what economists sometimes refer to as comparative advantage. So just like us as individuals, we're relatively good at doing some things and not so good at others. The same is true for countries overall. And the Apple iPhone is a wonderful example of the dynamism of the global economy. If you flip over the back of your iPhone, if you're listening to the show on it right now, there's a sentence that says, designed by Apple in California, assembled in China. And that reflects the experience and insight of Steve. Some of manufacturing activity requires manual dexterity, a lot of people and time. And those are ladders to prosperity for people in a lot of these emerging markets, just like it was the case that those types of similar jobs, say, in textiles and apparel, we're here in New England 200 years ago, and in the southeast of the U.S. 150 years ago. What all of us aspire to, I think, in the United States is good jobs at good wages. What that means today often is jobs that are connected to technology, to new and innovative capital. Those are the kinds of jobs that are the most sustainable ones for our country.
Arnie, why do you think China was such a target in this election, and was that misplaced or not?
I think that China, you know, it's the most populous country in the world, and it's got an economy that rivals ours in scope. And of course, we need to be talking about U.S. relations with China. I mean, like, why wouldn't we be? So I don't, you know, it's reasonable.
Do you think China was unfairly targeted as a bad actor?
I think that there are issues that I hope Matt understands them better than me that have to do with currency. And the relationship between global trade and currency issues that affect the balance trade. A lot of people say that the problem, in a sense, is that we have a trade deficit. Look, we import more than we export, and as long as we do that, we lose jobs. Or if we're importing stuff that we otherwise might have made here, then that affects jobs negatively in the United States. Now, how to change that is a pretty complicated proposition, but clearly because China is such a huge player on the field in terms of U.S. imports, that needs to be part of the discussion.
Matt, go ahead and jump in there, especially on the idea that people routinely see a trade deficit as a bad thing, and it might not necessarily be. It might be just a reflection of our overall wealth, and we can afford to buy stuff from elsewhere.
So anyways, there's a deep point here, which is when you think about trade imbalances, in a many-country complex global economy like the one in which we live, even a thriving country economically is going to have trade deficits with some countries, trade surpluses with other countries. The United States in recent years has continued to run a very large overall trade deficit with the world collectively. What that really reflects economically is the fact that our country as a whole doesn't save very much relative to our investment opportunities, so that savings imbalance is made up for by the rest of the world investing in the United States. So that's just another one of the features of the complexity of the global economy. And to bring it back to the TPP, in the TPP agreement were some new and innovative chapters that would have addressed how countries treat their currency, because that sometimes is a real force that affects the competitiveness of companies and therefore the jobs that they can support.
Here's another question from an emailer. Rob in Somersworth says, I think that lost jobs are an important part of the trade conversation, but I think the trade discussion is framed too often only in terms of jobs. Rob says, I think very few Americans understand the gains of trade in terms of cheap imports. And Matt, go ahead, you first on that, please.
So that's a great point. Some of the benefits tend to accrue very broadly to lots of us, especially as consumers. Come back to Steve's insight about the Apple iPhone. All of us collectively have benefited so much from the lower prices of iPhones that we have today relative to an imaginary world where we didn't have the assembly of a lot of the iPhone components in different countries around the world. And it speaks to a broader issue which has been present for a long time, which is oftentimes the pressures of trade or the pressures of technological change are very visible and concentrated, say, in a particular carrier plant in Indiana that the president has been talking about. What's oftentimes missed from these conversations is the gains and jobs that are being created by the opportunities that are being opened up in the rest of the world when we're connecting more to the global economy. Those gains are oftentimes 10 new people in one company in California and 5 new people in a company here in New Hampshire. So the concentration of the pressures, in no way to belittle those, they're very real. It's why we need to think about a stronger, better-funded social safety net. But the gains are oftentimes very broad, and it's important that we keep an eye on those gains because they have been large historically for the United States, and they have the potential to be large in the future as well.
Arne, I wonder what you think about that. I think I read one proposal during the campaign that Donald Trump said he wanted to increase tariffs on Chinese goods by 25% or 35%. That would raise the prices of a lot of goods in this country, including places where low-wage people
shop. Again, I don't
like
want to do too much speculating about what Donald Trump is or isn't going to do.
Yeah,
other
25%
than he's also
would be a
talking
lot.
About, you know, reducing taxes by a lot. And right now we've got the Republican leaders in New Hampshire talking about reducing taxes by a lot. And if that's happening, how we're going to come up with this stronger safety net that Matt and I agree we need to have in this integrated global economy, this is going to be a huge challenge. I mean, because we need to, again, if we want to be part of a vital global economy, we actually need stronger education. We need a better infrastructure. These are actually the things that New Hampshire employers are among the loudest voices in calling for. That means we need more investment in those things, which means that policies that supposedly are business friendly and that reduce our taxes are probably moving us in the wrong direction.
I wonder what you think, though, about the idea that it's so easy to say, you know, 1,000 workers lost their jobs here, 500 workers lost their jobs here. That's very easy and measurable. What's harder to measure, but maybe a bigger impact, I'm not sure, I haven't looked at it, is the impact of lower prices due to lower priced imports. Does that help everybody?
In a sense it does, and whether we're all helped or not by iPhones, I mean, I guess that's a maybe more of a philosophy question in a sense than an economics
that's
question.
That's for a whole other show.
That's a whole other show,
yeah.
Laura. But again, you've got to come back to where Matt started, that we're dealing with a generation or maybe two generations of stagnant wages for most American workers, while the people, the ultra wealthy, are doing extremely well. So that the issue of trade is very much mixed in with all these questions that have to do with wages, that have to do with the rising cost of healthcare, the shrinking middle class, the high cost of higher education, all of this stuff, automation. I mean, all of these things are all mixed in together that are making workers less secure, and not just feeling less secure, but actually less secure in this integrated global economy.
So,
I mean, the decisions about what is happening to all of our jobs are being made, in a sense, further and further from where we actually live and work.
So in that first part of what you said, Arne, yeah, it almost sounded like you're agreeing with Matt, you're agreeing with Secretary Kerry that there's a lot going on,
yeah,
not just trade.
No.
And so there's a lot more to address,
right,
than just trade.
But bring it back to the question of where is the power to make the decisions about all of these things? And are we headed toward oligarchy or are we dealing with democracy?
Well, and on that point, Judy says, regardless of the rules for trade, millions of Americans have been displaced and through no fault of their own will not return to employment at their previous wages. Judy says, isn't it time to strengthen the safety net rather than cutting budgets for social services, education, and healthcare? And I think both of you have already talked about that. Here's an email from Jack, actually, that came in a couple days ago. He says, it's been a long time since the mill buildings in Manchester and other New Hampshire cities housed workers making shoes and textiles. Those jobs went south, then overseas. Jack says, seeing those same buildings now filled with a variety of enterprises, including restaurants, publishers, architects, high-tech firms. Jack says, I wonder if the mill yard is an argument for free trade, i.e. the jobs lost to foreign competition have been replaced by better jobs as capital resources have been shifted to more productive uses. Jack, thank you for that email. And to both of you, but Arne, you first, the mills an argument in favor of free trade?
Well, I think the mills, that story is a great example when we talk about the ability of capital to move jobs and the difficulty that workers have in dealing with that. That's what happened when certainly when the Amisked closed, throwing tens of thousands of people out of work overnight, and then gradually decades of disappearance of other jobs in textiles and shoes. So it's taken Manchester now from the 1930s until the present time to recover. And I think that sort of if we're talking about five generations necessary to compensate for that, it's pretty difficult for me to say that this is an example of how successful this economic model is.
So a lot of suffering in between the old era and the new era.
Sure. Obviously, we're going to compensate over time, but that's an awfully large price to pay for the working people of Manchester, and as well as Somersworth and Nashua and all of these other New Hampshire mill towns that went through the same transformation over all these generations.
Matt, what do you think about Jack's point?
The mills that Jack talks about are just a lovely metaphor of two really important points, I think, that we've been discussing. The first is the aggregate benefits that the dynamism of technology and trade and all these forces generate. So I'm visualizing when I drive along there and I can see the technology companies and the publishers that you mentioned and there's restaurants. When you look at the aggregate data for the United States overall, we run very large trade surpluses with the overall world in these tradable services. And thanks to advances in technology with the internet and the cloud and so forth, the potential to have many more jobs in America connected to these now tradable services that we're very strong in, I think is a wonderful, optimistic image to hold on to in our minds. But Arnie was very articulate in pointing out the second key issue, though, that the mills point out, which is those gains have not directly benefited every single worker and family and community.
And it takes time.
This is the fundamental challenge. And it takes time, absolutely.
And so it's painful during that
You can talk about
transition.
Education. Right. And so I'm pro-education, definitely. But the clock of support for education ticks generation by generation. And given how fast some of these changes in the global economy happen, that should be one part of strengthening the social safety net, better funded, more innovative schools starting from preschool on. But there's so many other things that we in America need to be doing to broaden, modernize, and better fund our social safety net. Some of the main programs that we have today, like unemployment insurance and trade adjustment assistance, were created literally 50 to 80 years ago at a time when the United States economy was much smaller, much more stable, and that simply doesn't speak to the needs that our families in Manchester along the mills throughout the state and throughout our country need.
Well, a couple last questions for you guys, and then we'll have to close it out. To you first, I think, Matt, if the U.S. does pull back from some of these agreements, like the TPP, maybe renegotiating NAFTA or pulling out, we haven't even talked about that, imposes tariffs, whatever. If the U.S. does put some of these more protectionist measures in place, how might other countries react, Matt?
So the sobering reality is many other countries will say, too bad for them and good for us. The reality is there are so many countries around the world that literally have billions of people in them that aspire to be more connected to the opportunities and the creativity of the global economy. And the United States stepping aside from being part of setting those rules and participating in those opportunities, many countries, not unreasonably, will say this is more opportunity for us to write those rules and to gain from these potentials. China in particular, there was a summit that the president was at in Peru the week before last, and President Xi of China walked around the table, literally and metaphorically, and said to all the world leaders that were there with him and President Obama, China's looking to be a leader in integrating the global economy. Please join in the trade negotiations that we're putting together. So for many other countries, us stepping aside will not stop their desires to raise the opportunities for their workers and their citizens.
So China would love to see us pull back from the global trade stage, Matt, and then they could take our place. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely.
Arnie?
Yeah, I think we need to keep our eye on this whole picture. Again, while these while TPP has gone down, while maybe NAFTA, well, who knows what happens to that, a sweeping agreement with the European Union is probably going nowhere right now. But meanwhile, Laura, even deeper behind the scenes has been the negotiation of something called a trade and services agreement to try to create rules for the global service sector, which is huge, which is finance, which is education, which is construction, which is transportation, which is the internet. I mean, all of this stuff. And that is also going on secretly behind the scenes. And the boosters for that are companies like Citigroup and MetLife and Walmart. And if we think that their interests are the same as our interests, then maybe that's a good thing. And if we suspect that our interests might be different from the interests of Citigroup and Walmart, then we need to be extremely skeptical and we need to demand that that process come out into the open the way the TPP eventually did.
And I have heard about that agreement, that negotiation, yep. Arnie. And I've also read that some people think that this is now, you know, in jeopardy.
Well, again, it's not something that Mr. Trump has talked about, so who knows?
All right. Well, lots of who
knows. You'll have many shows on what Mr. Trump will do.
And many shows on this topic. We didn't even get to NAFTA, really, and if that's renegotiated. Arnie, thank you so much for being here. I really appreciate it.
Great to be here.
Arnie Alpert, New Hampshire co-director of the American Friends Service Committee. Matt Slaughter, great to have you, too. We always appreciate your time.
Thank you, Laura. It's always a pleasure.
Remember, our conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our intern is Liz Torrey. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. Hey, if you like what you heard, spread the word. Please give us a review on iTunes to help other listeners find us. And thanks.